what we'll be hearing today. It's not on the original bill. We had almost a four-hour hearing on the original bill. This is on the amendments. If you haven't had a chance to pick them up, they're right in the back, right by Ms. Pyle over there. And also, if you have written testimony, please hand that in to the committee staff, and I'm going to ask you to please summarize your written testimony and not read it, because we obviously can do that. Anything else, Patrick, that you can think of?
No, I believe that that outlines it pretty well, Madam.
Okay, so with that, I will officially open up the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee hearing for April 9th. I would like to say that my committee administrator is excused today. Unfortunately, she had a death in the family. So we're fortunate to have Patrick here with us. And so since Beth couldn't be here, I've asked the legislative drafter, Doug Tukey, who worked very hard on these amendments to get us here in a timely fashion, to just come up and walk us through the amendment section by section, and then we're going to relieve him to go back to his duties to work on more amendments for this committee. And we appreciate you being here, Doug, and your hard work.
Thank you.
Committee members, I just will mention that we heard a lot of testimony on the original bill. Many groups have been meeting over the past few weeks with us. We've incorporated a lot of the comments that we've heard into this version that you see here. I'm not going to say it's perfect. That's why we are having yet another public hearing today. So we appreciate the hard work of everybody who contributed to this, and we're looking forward to hearing your comments. We will be limiting, because of the amount of people that we have, to 2 minutes. So I'm going to ask people to really be succinct. And certainly, if you've already, if your comments have already been shared, if there's a possibility to just submit your written testimony, that would be greatly appreciated by the chair and committee members. With that, Doug, thank you for being here. And if you could just remember to state your name for the record and walk us through section by section, that would be helpful.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Doug Tukey from the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I'll briefly go over the amendments which we prepared for Senate Bill 80. Section 1 contains a requirement that all agencies prepare a greenhouse gas emissions reduction plan in order to meet the goals that were established last session on 468A205. It also includes rulemaking authority for them, and Section 2 then sets a deadline which hasn't yet been specified. Section 3 creates a Climate Policy Advisory Council. If you'll note at the end of the bill in Section 18, there's a series of statutes that have been repealed, and those all relate to the Oregon Global Warming Commission, which was created last session. The bill does not repeal the sections dealing with legislative findings or the greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals or the section dealing with definitions. Those stay in place. The bill includes several requirements for the commission. If you look on page 2, line 23, one of the main duties of the commission is to play a coordinating role. And so that's in Section 5, Subsection B. Section 4 is a temporary provision, and that requires the council to collect all the plans for the state agencies that are required in Section 1 and to prepare a report and to submit that to the next two legislative sessions. Section 5 begins several other sections of the bill dealing with plans. Section 5 deals with the Public Utilities Commission and requires them to create a plan for electric companies to meet greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. So you can see several sections in there. And then Section 6, again, has a temporary section dealing with a report that's to be given to the legislative session, next legislative session. It also includes a requirement that the PUC review all their statutes and rules and offer recommendations to the next legislative session for that. Section 7 and 8 deal with Department of Transportation. They're also required to develop a plan to meet the greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. Section 8, again, then requires them to develop rules and also to develop a report to be presented to the next legislature. This model is carried over in Sections 9 and 10. EQC similarly will develop a plan for stationary sources. and will also prepare a report in Section 10 to the next legislature. Section 11 and 12 are Senate Bill 38 from this session, and that's the reporting requirements. Section 468 is, as you know, the chapter dealing with air quality, so that's added to that. Section 13 is House Bill 3155 from this section, and this deals with consumer-owned utilities. Section 14 is a new section, and that establishes an offset advisory committee, which the Climate Policy Advisory Council is required to work with. Section 15 and 16 are sections dealing with whistleblower protection. That provides protection for employees who are discharged, demoted, or suspended for reporting violations of this act. Section 16 adds that and provides that a court can order injunctive relief or other equitable relief to make up for a violation of Section 15. Section 18, we already mentioned, that repeals all the provisions dealing with the Global Warming Commission. So those are the main points.
Okay. Thank you very much,
yeah.
Doug. I know that you're super busy, so we're not going to keep you, but I appreciate you coming here today to walk us through this since our committee staff is out. And we, the chair and the committee members, really appreciate your hard work.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, with that, we have a lot of people that are going to come up. We're going to start calling folks up, and we have a very complicated system here. It's very high-tech. When we get near the 15-second mark, we will hold up a sign, and when your time's up, your time's up. And again, if you have written testimony, we encourage you to paraphrase it and make sure and hand it to our committee staff, and we appreciate everybody here today. I know you're all interested in making sure that your comments get heard, and we certainly are very excited to see so many people interested in this issue. So with that, I'm going to call it first. We have a special guest, the former Secretary of State, Bill Bradbury, who I know needs to go, so I am going to take the chair's prerogative and call him up first. Yeah. Okay, well, yes, I know Bill has to go, so I'll come. Okay. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam yes. Chair, members of the committee. I should introduce myself, Bill Bradbury. I am appearing before you today as a private citizen. I am a member of the Global Warming Commission, but I'm not here representing specifically the Global Warming Commission. And I wanted to just speak very briefly in favor of Senate Bill 80. I think it is critical that this state establish some mandatory carbon emission limits to really deal with the global warming problem. I think it's not boastful for me to say that I have actually spoken to more people in this state about global warming than anybody else in this state. And the reason I say that is because I have been doing presentations on global warming all over the state for the last 2.5 years, and I've done presentations and I've had discussions with the people in the audience. And those presentations have taken place in very diverse areas. I've done 189 presentations now, ranging from Northeast Oregon in Enterprise to Southwest Oregon in Cave Junction. And I have to say that the attitudes that I found in those presentations has really changed. And there is a significant shift that's taking place, and that there is a greater understanding amongst the citizens that there really is a problem we need to deal with in terms of global warming. And basically, a lot of people used to come to presentations and raise questions. Fewer and fewer people come and raise questions. More and more people come and say, we want to find solutions. I had a chance to present to students this morning at Dallas High School, and they were really focused on solutions. I had a chance to present to 300 students yesterday or the day before yesterday at Sunset High School in Beaverton, and I'm struck by a question that one of the students asked, and she said, we clearly can do a lot individually to deal with this problem, but we've got to have the government help, don't we? And I said very clearly, yes, it's both individuals and the government. We're not going to solve the problem unless we put both of them together, and that's really what I think comes comes to your hands today is really for the government to take a leadership role in addressing the carbon problem. And I encourage you to do so.
Great. Thank you very much, Bill. We appreciate you being here today. We know that you have to run off for another engagement, so thank you for being here.
Thank you for allowing me the time.
Great. Thanks so much.
All right.
Okay. Senator Nelson, I see you back there, so come on up. And just so you know, we tend to allow our elected colleagues to come up first, so that's why he's cutting in line from all of you.
Madam Chair, thank
you. He's going to lead a good example by doing 2 minutes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29, and you know, thank you very much, because you know that I'm going to come in and oppose this bill. You know, every party has its pooper. That's why.
Can you state your name too, Senator?
Yeah, David Nelson. I thought I did. State Senator from District 29. I've sent out some handouts for you. You can read through that. Basically, CO2, carbon dioxide, is classified as a greenhouse gas. It's a good gas. It creates its photosynthesis. It makes things grow. Why are we trying to stop it? And if you look at an ice age, occurs when you have 170 to 190 parts per million. We were down to 288. It looks to me like we're getting a lot closer to an ice age than we were getting to global warming. And what they're telling me is, at least the scientists that I'm talking to are indicating that about 1,000 parts per million is the optimum amount that we should have for growing plants. The biggest greenhouse gas is water vapor. How is this bill going to handle this? 75% of the Earth's surface is covered with water. We have two real-life experiences with global warming and carbon dioxide. One is the Depression. You have a handout there. During the Depression, there was a 30% reduction in carbon dioxide, and yet the temperatures continued to rise, and carbon dioxide in the air has continued to also rise. You also have the medieval warming period, from about year 8,000 AD to 14,000 AD, where temperatures were higher, carbon dioxide concentrations were higher. That was pre-industrial revolution, not man-made. And then you also have the Vostok, what they call the Vostok ice cores, which basically proves that the heating of the planet precedes the heating of, or the precedes the rise in carbon dioxide. And that's because carbon dioxide comes from the ocean. That's the greatest carbon sink. So thank you, and please register my objection to this bill.
Thank you, Senator. And next I'm going to call up, and I will tell you that we're going to go till about 5 o'clock this evening, so we're going to try to get as many people in as possible, and if we need to go over for another hearing, we may do that. I'm just going to let people know that we're going to try to do our best, but appreciate you keeping to 2 minutes, and we'll get as many people up as possible. And we're going to do some alternating here. First up, Andrew Durbin, Dennis Wild, and actually I'm going to have David Vantoff come up. We're going to do
four.
So Mike Rainey. Just going to have folks come up, and since we've got four chairs, it'll expedite a little bit. So we'll start on this end and work over that way.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Durbin. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Environmental Council. And today we encourage your support of SB 80. We think that this is a reasonable compromise that will achieve the goals set out by the 2007 legislature. And I should let you know that we have for several weeks now been, at the request of the legislators, been in negotiations with representatives from utilities industry. And this bill, the amended version, reflects the compromises and some of the concerns that were tabled and introduced by the environmental community as well as those interests. This is not a cap-and-trade bill. This is not a carbon tax bill. This is not a hard cap bill. This is a bill that sets a sector-by-sector approach and looking at how do we deliver on the goals set out by the state, by the legislature in 2007, creates a roadmap, creates a plan with clear timelines, objectives, and a process for meeting those goals. And I'd just like to highlight two reasons why this is important. First, the 2007 goals set out by the legislature were an important first step, but they do not get us to where we need to be by 2020. There's no guarantee. I kind of liken it to, for example, if I wanted to lose 5 pounds, I'm not going to lose weight by thinking about it desiring to do it and trying to, you know, fit back into that dress, I'm going to do it by cutting my intake of food and exercising. And the same analogy can be applied to the 2007 greenhouse gas reduction goals. We're not going to see action in Oregon until we have a process and a process for moving forward on a sector-by-sector approach for making those reductions. And that's clear because today, many of our largest utilities today haven't really taken those goals seriously in mapping out a plan. Secondly, it helps position Oregon to be ahead of the curve and really drive the train in the climate discussions. We need to make sure that Oregon industries are more competitive in a carbon-constrained world. It puts dollars back into working families' pockets and companies because it enables us to use less energy, creates family wage jobs, and improves the quality of life and health for Oregonians. There are a couple of highlights I'd like to make in the bill that are changes from what you've seen previously. One is that it drops the tradable credits program. Two, it creates this climate council. Three, there's an advisory committee that sets up clear criteria for purchasing of carbon offsets. Offsets are a real opportunity for both the agriculture and forestry sector in the state of Oregon. It also will help potentially address timber-dependent counties in the state. And finally, it acknowledges that the industrial sector will need more time to prepare for greenhouse gas reductions, and it gives them more time to implement them by 2014.
Okay, Andrew, I'm going to have to cut you off there, and hopefully Dennis can pick up where you dropped off. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Committee. My name is Dennis Wild. I'm with Girding Edlin Development. We're a real estate development company headquartered in Portland, Oregon. We do work up and down the west coast of the U.S. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 80. Two of the major challenges that we face today, the economic crisis and the need to solve climate change, share a common derivation and set of solutions. Ecology and economy both spring from the same word, ecos, which means to study and manage the household. These are not competing objectives. They have to function together. We know through the study of our natural world that we're in deep trouble. Now it's time to use our economic management to craft a livable and successful future that recognizes the limits of the natural systems. Just as a farmer would not eat his seed corn, we need to set limits on pollution of the atmosphere and focus on investments in clean energy, better efficiency, stronger building standards to reduce consumption and use, transportation choices that are independent of oil and coal. Our one example of how this might work is imagine renovating a research building at one of the university campuses and in the process reducing the consumption by 55%. Imagine such a project paying for itself in 10 years. Imagine Pacific Core or PGE partnering with the building owner to finance the project, make a profit, and are allowed to use the energy or carbon reduction emission credits towards their allocation. This is just one example of the creative application of the private sector with the public good, and we believe that this bill can help to push Oregon towards a strong renewable economy. I urge your approval of Senate Bill 80. Thank you.
Exactly 2 minutes. You get the award. Thank you, Dennis. David.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dave Vantoff from the Governor's Office. I'll hopefully save some time in my remarks. I just wanted to speak on behalf of the governor and state testify in support of this bill in the context that the governor a while back came to the committee and introduced Senate Bill 80. It was his attempt to try and move the ball forward in Oregon in terms of establishing real greenhouse gas reductions and, as was noted, to develop tools to achieve the statutory reduction goals. But he also recognized that his approach might not be the one that folks were going to move with, and he encouraged others to step forward and with their concrete ideas. And I think what you see before you today is just that. The governor is very encouraged by legislators who have stepped forward, stakeholders who have stepped forward, to try and come up with a compromise approach that can still take significant steps forward in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and putting us on a long-term trajectory for economic growth and health. We haven't had a chance to read the amendments in detail, so I'm not going to comment in specificity. But I think generally, from the concepts that I've heard from Doug Tukey, the bill will do the types of things that the governor supports, which is take significant steps forward and move the ball down the road. So we're very supportive of moving the bill forward.
Mike. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mike Graney from the Oregon Department of Energy. We also support the bill and the Dash 3 amendments. I think this does move us forward significantly towards achieving the greenhouse gas reduction targets. Sets out a framework for making real progress on those targets. And I think it also positions us well, given the uncertainty in the economic situation, still gives us flexibility on adjusting specific measures to meet those targets. I also think it positions the state well in the event there is federal legislation in the next couple of years establishing a cap and trade nationwide program, because this will give the state charting a course for moving forward to meet those targets. So that concludes my remarks.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions for this these witnesses? Senator Boquist, sorry.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair.
That's
all right. Could you just highlight, I mean, you said it was kind of a work group compromise, might not be the right word or whatever, between industry and stuff. Who participated in the work group?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, hopefully I'll be able to get everybody around the table. The discussions included representatives from the IOUs, PGE, PacifiCorp, the COUs,
customer-owned utilities,
and the warehouser was there. Pulp and paper representative was there. Transportation representatives came and went, but they were part of some bilateral discussions as well, from AAA and from the Oregon Truckers Association.
Thank you.
Union.
And then on the environment, do you want to hear the environmental representatives?
Okay.
Included Oregon Environmental Council, Environment Oregon, Sierra Club. Who am I missing?
Citizens Utility Board.
Citizens Utility Board.
And there were union representatives?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we're going to hear from some industrial folks, John Morris and Kelly Howell. And let's see, I'm just trying to get folks up here as quickly as possible. Actually, Brock Howell and Ramona Baker, why don't you come up as well? Hey, John, if you want to get started.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is John Morris. I'm the director at Fluid Market Strategies. We're an energy consulting firm in Portland, Oregon. And I had 6 points written. I'm going to read 2. So basically, I want to speak to the benefits of this bill passing, specifically as it relates to energy efficiency efforts. Delivering energy efficiency will promote green jobs. And in the first quarter of 2009, our company has grown from 19 to 21 employees. We expect to be at 30 employees by the end of the fourth quarter next year, by up to 100. And that will be driven by a bill like this passing. We will be able to provide green jobs in the state. The other one I want to say is Oregon is currently one of the country's leaders in energy efficiency, but we really have just scratched the surface. Studies show that we can continue to find efficiencies and reduce energy by an average of 25% if we employ comprehensive strategies. Energy efficiency provides a good part of the solution to climate change. However, like many new ideas, energy efficiency takes work and dedication. A climate bill will provide motivation that will lead to that action. It is time to embrace the concept that protecting the environment, specifically dramatically curbing carbon emissions, can be an effective engine of economic growth, job creation, and even poverty reduction. Both labor and environmental organizations for the first time are behind this effort. Now is the time to pass Senate Bill 80. This will be the work of our generation. It will engage a broad range of people and activities, and it is an opportunity that cannot be lost.
Thank you. Councilor Lindgren next.
Great. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify here in support of Senate Bill 80. My name is Kelly Hale. I work as an associate for Good Company, which is a sustainability research and consulting firm based in Eugene, Oregon. We have worked with more than 25 different organizations in terms of conducting greenhouse gas inventories, developing and executing climate action plans to achieve emissions reductions, and understanding and planning for climate risk, which is what I want to touch on here today. When we work with organizations to focus on climate risk, we talk about their risks from physical risk and regulatory risk. On the physical side, they're open to changes in our natural environment, such as extreme weather events and changes in temperatures, precipitation, and stream flow patterns. As the chair of the International Panel on Climate Change recently said, if there is no action by 2012, that is too late. What we do in the next 2 to 3 years will determine our future. This is the defining moment. I think the science is clear, and we cannot afford to end this session without establishing a plan and a framework to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Oregon. The other area that we focus on when we work with businesses is helping them understand their regulatory risk from a cost of carbon coming into our economy. In order to calculate regulatory risk, an organization must first conduct a greenhouse gas inventory to figure out what their emissions actually are. The organization next needs to know what the price will be to emit a ton of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. And this is the area where there's the most uncertainty right now, and businesses can't make any future projections because that price is completely unknown. You all have the ability to give more certainty to businesses in helping to plan for the future by passing Senate Bill 80. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. And you guys are showing the same organization, so I'm going to ask only one of you to speak, please.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. Please excuse me. I had just left the House Land Use Committee right before I was going to testify, so I actually am here right now. So I am Brock Howell with Environment Oregon, and Ramona Baker is also here at the table. And we are a citizen-based organization with 30,000 members statewide to protect our clean air, clean water, and open space. And we are here to in support of Senate Bill 80. We have a momentous occasion to be able to set up our state the right way to make sure that we have job creation and savings through energy efficiency and public transportation, and to make sure we have viable, livable communities. And I'd like to talk about transportation in particular under this bill. Transportation amounts to upwards of 40% of our global warming pollution for our state. So it is critical that we tackle this issue within a comprehensive climate bill like this. And we believe that the mechanism in place to do it is a good one of setting out a plan that we will be able to, that the agencies will be able to look at the best approach to do that and enact through its existing statutory authority those provisions that it can do now, and then look forward into the future of what we need to do in the future. And so we strongly urge you to continue down this path of working from this particular legislation that we've been just handed for us, this newest amendment. And so we thank you for your time, and we're happy to work with the committee as we have been for the past several weeks.
Thank you. And any questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much. Okay, next up, Craig Campbell, Bob Russell, and Tim Miller. And let's see if I can pull somebody else up there. I'm just going to start calling people, especially who have come from far away. So I'm going to call up Jennifer Hudson. Just a reminder, turn your phones off. Heard that. Well, I only have room for four, so if you want to wait for the next round, I was trying to call up somebody.
We could wait till the next.
Okay. Craig Campbell. Okay. All right. So, yeah, Craig's not here, so why don't you two? You can. We've got enough chairs. Bob, why don't you start?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association, and you have what is my written testimony coming to you right now. What it talks about is the state of the trucking industry today. If you look at the middle paragraph, what it says is that in January of this year, we lost 24,900 jobs. From December of 2007 through January of 2009, a 14-month period, we lost 106,000 jobs. So nearly 25% of that drop in employment came in January of this year. February, we lost 34,800 jobs, and we do not yet have the results for March, but we expect them to be worse. We recently received our long-range forecast, and this economy is expected to continue for the next 18 to 24 months. Here in Oregon, most of my members have trucks parked. They've laid off employees. Some are down as much as 60%. This is a very unsettling time for businesses in general, and particularly for those of us in the trucking industry. Last time I was here, I talked about the things that the trucking industry is already doing to address climate change. I also talked about the fact that we recognize that we need to do more. And I talked about some of the things that we had worked on with the environmental community in the interim that are in House Bill 2120, the transportation package. And how gratified I was, as a lot in the transportation community, with the relationships that we had developed with the environmental community doing that work. We've also had some discussions regarding language in this bill, and I'm going to leave that to Mr. Campbell to talk about. What I'd like to conclude with is this bill has what I see as a hard cap. A hard cap is a very difficult thing for business to deal with. Uncertainty is one of the things that we avoid. This economy has made conditions generally uncertain, and to impose a hard cap with the most aggressive goals in the country is something that is very difficult for the industry to deal with.
So, Bob, I have a quick question for you. My understanding is that, and we've talked about, you know, we talked to you, and thank you for participating, working with legislators, that language in this bill was actually offered by the transportation sector, and I don't know if you're going to talk to that, but that was my understanding. So I don't know if you can speak to the language that's in here. I don't know if you've just had a chance to look at it or if you can follow up in writing. That would be helpful.
Could we just ask, Bob, if your comments today are on the dash threes or the dash twos or something before?
They are on the dash threes that we just received before the hearing. And, Madam Chair, to respond to your question, I've had a few moments to look at the transportation section. As with a lot of things, it's not exactly the language that we thought was going to be in the bill, and I need a little more time to digest it. I'll be happy to follow up with you at a later time.
Okay, thank you. I think, yeah, you're next because he just punted to you and said you're going to talk about the language in the bill.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
I'm sorry.
Craig Campbell. No.
I thought you said Tim Miller. I'm sorry.
Let's just do it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. My name is Tim Miller, and I'm the president and CEO of a startup vehicle company. We've prototyped a 100-mile-per-gallon vehicle. The company is called Greenlight Motors. I'd like to make three quick points in support of this bill related to transportation. First, transportation is a critical component of our state's carbon footprint, and we can make tremendous strides in reducing the carbon intensity of our transportation. The sting of last summer's $4 gas really convinced consumers that they'll face rising fuel costs in the future, and manufacturers have woken up as well. So every vehicle manufacturer has announced programs for dramatically more efficient vehicles in 2010 and 2011. So the vehicles will be there. Right here in Oregon, we have several startups doing this, Greenlight Motors, Brammo, Porteon, Arcimoto, Buggy, and others. So the demand is there. The products are coming. So we can dramatically reduce our greenhouse gases from vehicle transportation. Second, jobs. Encouraging more efficient vehicles will create green-collar jobs in many sectors. Our own plans include creating hundreds of green-collar jobs. Oregon is already recognized as a green car opportunity area, with Nissan and BYD looking to market here and companies like Think looking to manufacture here. Third, efficient vehicles save money. Whether an all-electric vehicle or a more efficient hybrid vehicle, these vehicles save money for consumers. Finally, two quick comments. A cautionary note, when implementing policies around this legislation, we have to be careful that there will be two-wheeled and three-wheeled vehicles, not all like our old four-wheeled vehicles, to drive this increased efficiency. Finally, a historical note, an insight from the history of the automotive industry may be helpful. We've long known that we needed to make our vehicles more efficient, but since the 70s, Detroit pushed back on increased efficiency, and we all know where that has led Detroit today. So, with smart policies, we can dramatically reduce the carbon intensity of our transportation, and we can save jobs and save money.
Okay. Thank you. And we have your written testimony, correct?
Yep.
Thank you very much. And you magically transformed from Bob Russell to Craig. So we'll finish up on the transportation theme.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA. The language that you see in Section 7 was as a result of some negotiation that occurred between myself, Bob Russell, and Andrea Durbin to try and capture the transportation portion of limiting greenhouse gases over time. Transportation accounts for about 43% of the greenhouse gases you're trying to deal with and reduce. What we wanted to do is create a structure that allowed for agencies to do what they're already authorized to do, but at the same time work together to see if there aren't some additional solutions that can be produced that would reduce greenhouse gases. What we're asking is that as those agencies that are involved in that come together to discuss creative options, that to the extent that they're asking for new authority, that they come back to the legislature to have the legislature vet those pieces and that the legislature has a chance to debate them and then implement them. It also specifically makes a connection with what up to this point in time has been House Bill 2120 on transportation, where we also have language there that does three things. It creates a least cost planning process for transportation. It deals with some planning processes around land use and MPOs, and I'll say at this point in time that I have spent my life trying to avoid getting involved in land use discussions to the extent I can, and those amendments reflect no change on that policy. The third is to create a side-by-side lease cost planning, a cost allocation study, one that is traditional and the other one that takes into account additional factors such as noise, greenhouse gas emissions, and things like that. When you're dealing with the transportation sector, there are really three ways you can look at greenhouse gas reductions. One is through technology, and we hope that through the advent of electric vehicles and so forth, that you'll be able to reduce greenhouse gases that way. There's also increasing the cost of travel so that you try to direct people to use the roads less. AAA members don't really like that very much. And then there's the land use portion that I don't know anything about, but it is a way to give people choices so that you don't have to travel as far if you're going to make a trip to the store or so forth.
Thank you. Any questions for the transportation folks? Yeah. Senator Brzozinski.
Craig, Bob made some mention that he felt the Dash 3s retained a hard cap. We heard testimony before that said there was no caps. Can you point us to where the caps that he's relying on?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzozinski, I have not had a chance to look at that portion of the language, so I don't know if there's a hard cap in here or not. If there is, of course, we're not comfortable with a hard cap, but I couldn't point you to it because I don't know if it's in there.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner, I apologize for sandwiching you in between the transportation folks, and I would like to say that your brother resides in my district, and welcome.
He'll hear about this, huh?
I might hear about it later. So
yeah,
thank you for coming all the way from Baker City. I don't know if you came here today specifically for that, but we appreciate it.
Okay. I think Jennifer's going to start.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Hudson. I'm here today on behalf of Ashgrove Cement Company. Ashgrove is the largest U.S.-owned cement company, and it is the one and only cement manufacturer in the state of Oregon. It's located in Durkee, east of Baker City. And here today, as you pointed out, I have Baker County Commissioner Fred Warner with me. Commissioner Warner is a member of Ashgrove's Community Advisory Council. That's a very integral part of our community relations efforts out in the Baker community, and he will be able to familiarize you more with Ashgrove's import to the Baker County area. But first, let me familiarize you with Ashgrove. Ashgrove employs 118 Oregonians at a payroll of nearly $9 million per year. They also paid more than $1.7 million in property taxes last year and $600,000 in corporate taxes. As the only cement plant in the state and an industrial source of greenhouse gas emissions that would qualify for regulation under each and every plan proposed to date, Ashgrove has serious concerns and opposes SB 80-3 amendments and the idea of a state hard cap or any cap-and-trade program. Chief among our concerns is that a state-by-state or regional program that puts commodities like cement at a competitive disadvantage compared with competitors outside the controlled region is problematic. This phenomenon is known as leakage. And we also think a federal program applying equally to all 50 states would keep a level playing field amongst all the states. And so we prefer any program to take shape at the national level. And with that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Warner.
Thank you. Welcome again, Commissioner Warner.
Thank you. My name is Fred Warner. I'm the County Commission Chair for Baker County. I also serve as the Budget Officer and on the Economic Development Council. I also, like Craig, I wish I could stay away from land use issues, but I can't. So I would like to just put a face to Ash Grove, and Ash Grove is our main industry in Baker County. It employs nearly 100 people. It actually pays 20% of the property taxes that come to Baker County. So I would like to echo what Jennifer said about, I think we need to use caution and have flexibility in anything that we do. 30 years ago, we had 7 mills in Baker County. Today, we have none. We lost our timber base. Most of those timber workers went to work at Ash Grove, and if Oregon unilaterally puts together a program that doesn't reflect what's going on in the United States or globally, we could lose those jobs. And from the county commissioner's perspective in Baker County, we need to use caution. We want to make sure that we do find solutions, but the solutions that we find, we want to be able to keep industry, because we are, just like the rest of the state, in dire economic straits right now, and we don't see much on the horizon, and we need to keep what we do have in Baker County.
Thank you for coming out here today. Are there any questions, Senator Brzezinski?
Yeah. Jennifer, you gave in your testimony something about hard caps as well. I've skimmed through this. I just got it there when I walked in here today, so I will be the first to say I don't know every word that's in here, but I skimmed it and do not see any reference to caps. Mm-hmm. Could you point to me where in the dash-3s it says hard caps?
Thank you, Chair. Senator Brzezinski, like everyone, I just received this amendment as well, the dash-3s, and we didn't really know what we were going to be facing today as we came to the hearing. And so, in general, Ash Grove is opposed to hard caps.
You weren't testifying there with the dash threes.
No, but we're opposed to the dash threes as well. Okay. So.
But she hasn't had a chance to read them.
Right.
Well, excuse me. I don't know the specifics of the hard cap, but it's similar enough.
I think his point is that there isn't a hard cap specifically in the bill. So, but if you want, you're welcome to send in, if you have additional comments, you can also send them in, because we'll have the record open.
Okay, thank you. Could I say one other thing? I think in my quick read, it does allow rulemaking authority to DEQ that could result in a hard cap, and we are opposed to that broad of an authority.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. I do just want to mention, before I forget, because it's a fair city of one of our committee members, there's a letter, committee members from the city of Eugene, that's been submitted for the record. I don't see them signed up, so this is now in the public record. Thank you for that reminder. Okay, next up, I think we're going to call up some utility folks, as we haven't heard from them yet, and then we have people from over 100 miles. I want to make sure they get heard. We have a lot of lobbyists that if we don't get to you today, we will certainly get to you another day, but I want to make sure the folks from far away get a chance to have their voice heard. We're trying to get through all the sectors. Going to invite up Dave Robertson, Scott Bolton, and Marcy Putnam. Marcy, why don't you go first? We'll let ladies go first.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcy Putman, and I'm the political affairs representative for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 125. On behalf of our 3,500 members, I want to explain why we cannot support the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 80. Nearly 2,200 of our members are Oregonians, and they work for investor-owned utilities, cooperatives, PUTs, and municipalities throughout the state. We believe the impact of this bill will be greatest on those who live and work in rural Oregon if generation plants are closed or their operations reduced. The majority of employees who work at Boardman Generation Plant live in Morrow or Umatilla counties. And according to the Oregon Employment Department, as of February 2009, unemployment in Morrow was 10.5% and Umatilla was 11.2%. And with Beaver Generation Plant being located in Columbia County, which has been classified as a distressed area by the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, it's important to note that the county already has a 14% unemployment rate. Progress is being made, and we're proud to help make that happen. Renewable energy is being added to the transmission grid and more generations planned. However, we have to have firm generation to back it up, and those plants help provide that generation. To maintain system reliability, safety, and Oregon's economic future, we should not make it impossible for these plants to remain viable. Enron taught us the need for diversity, and our electric portfolio should not be any different. With no other state pursuing such aggressive targets, Oregon's on this path by itself. Your constituents and Oregon ratepayers cannot afford this journey. We can reduce greenhouse gas emissions without placing Oregonians' economic future in jeopardy. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Marcy. Scott?
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Bolton, representing PacifiCorp. PacifiCorp serves over 1.7 million customers across six western states. We're proud to serve Oregon as Pacific Power, where we serve approximately 550,000 customers. With customers and assets in 31 of Oregon's 36 counties, we are Oregon's largest rural power provider and one of Oregon's largest rural employers and taxpayers. In the interest of time, I'll hit the high points of my testimony since I've had quite a bit of interaction with the chair and the stakeholder group over the last couple weeks. While we do believe that the Dash 3 Amendment does represent some progress and some reflection of those discussions that we have been having, it does not yet achieve the balance that we think is necessary to support Senate Bill 80 at this point. The Dash 3 amendments do still contain a hard cap on emissions, both from the utility sector as well as, I believe, across the economy. Section 1 speaks to this as far as Ms. Hudson's testimony points out, as well as Section 5, which is specific to the role of the Public Utility Commission with the investor-owned utilities.
Scott, I just want to make sure. Section 1 is for agency plans. So I just want to make sure you're looking at the Dash 3s.
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, I guess to follow up on that, in Section 1, 1A, where it does say in order that the agency's plans, emissions reductions plans, essentially must meet greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals specified in ORS 468A.
For that agencies, is state agencies, not private.
Correct. And then Section 5, Senator, is specific to public utility regulation.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't dock you for answering my question.
We've estimated that compliance with this hard cap, as specified in 468A 205, would cost our customers billions over the next 9 years to meet a 10% reduction goal below 1990 levels by 2020. The rate of increases associated with complying with this hard cap would be staggering to the state and disastrous for our customers. Oregon going alone on a hard cap causes our customers to miss out on the traditional cost sharing that we have with our five other states as we resource plan and share those costs among the states. Essentially what that means is that we would have to build a generation portfolio to meet only Oregon's needs. That's costly and probably a poor deployment of capital. One thing, I know Ms. Durbin's testimony didn't speak specifically to my company. Nobody has done more than PacifiCorp over the last 36 months to decarbonize its product and to deploy renewable generation into their portfolio. In 2006, we had 36.2 megawatts of owned renewable generation. By the end of this year, we will have over 1,200 megawatts. It's an incredible increase, but that's an increase without its cost, with cost.
Okay.
Does that count for the questions?
Yes.
Okay. I look forward to questions.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Robertson. I'm the Government Affairs Director for Portland General Electric. I think, as you know, PGE serves about 810,000 customers in Oregon. We're a supporter of the Renewable Energy Standard and very committed to greenhouse gas reduction actions. The Dash 3 amendments, as we've read them, I agree with the representative from PacifiCorp, contain a hard cap for utilities in Section 5, bottom of page 5. We really believe that a hard cap mandate to reduce to the goals in the next 9 years will put unacceptable rate and reliability impacts on our system. The rate impacts and cost impacts on customers we feel could be in the $7 billion range. And the reason for that is we'd have to shut down power plants and build brand new power plants to replace those in a very short period of time. By 2020, we believe that would institute a rate increase on our customers of approximately 75 to 100%. We believe that's just unacceptable. So we do support scoping and planning in this bill. We support taking a look at what greenhouse gas reductions we can get, how much they'll cost, and what order we ought to put those in to get the best bang for the buck for our customers. But to be forced to do those, we believe, creates some unintended consequences. Part of the problem is that the 1990 goals, we believe, are unrealistic. We all believed, I think, and agreed as those were put into place that they'd be aspirational. Now, as we turn those into mandates and we start to do some analysis about what that would mean, we're coming up with these types of numbers. Part of the PG problem is that in 1990, we were 64% of our load was met with generation that was non-emitting generation. Nuclear plants, double the hydro we have now. In 2008, we have 31% of our plants that are non-emitting generation. And in Oregon, the goals in the state are actually three times higher than California's goals, and three times higher than Washington and Arizona, and twice California and New Mexico. If we implement them as a mandate, we believe Oregon will be placed at a competitive disadvantage, and our customers will as well. So we're more than willing to continue to stay at the table and work on this, but a hard cap mandate is simply just something we cannot accept. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions for Scott and Dave, because I was looking through my notes after our discussions this morning, and right before the start of the 2009 session, I had information on the coordinated utility position on climate issues for 2009 that I pulled out, and it stated, I'm just reading you what it stated, we believe that the Oregon legislature should direct the Oregon Public Utility Commission and the local governing boards of the consumer-owned utilities to achieve real reductions at a reasonable pace with acceptable rate impacts. These carbon reduction actions should be considered as early actions under federal cap-and-trade legislation. And so how do the current Senate Bill 80 amendments differ from that position that you had? And I will direct this to the utilities.
Okay. Madam Chair, Dave Robertson again from PGE. I believe that position is one that we still support. I believe the thing that has changed is that as we've looked at how the language is applied, when the language actually says that we shall meet the goals of 1990, that forces us to a hard cap situation. So we do support scoping and planning for these recommendations and for actual actions to reduce greenhouse gases, but we really need to understand what the costs of those are going to be and what actual greenhouse gases we're going to reduce. We'd like to be able to stack those up and pick the lowest hanging fruit first and do those. Right now, a hard cap without a number of flexibility tools to help us get there just forces us to some of the most expensive reduction actions first.
So I just want to be clear. You're calling the goals that were adopted by this legislative body last session the hard cap. I just want to make sure we're using the same language, because that's what I'm hearing. By saying that you have to meet these goals, this is a hard cap.
Yes, Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee.
Okay, and then in a draft bill that was presented by PG&E and PacifiCorp, this was presented to committee members early in the session. It said that the PUC shall, and I'm reading the language, shall develop a plan. The plan shall meet the goals established by ORS 468A.205, which are the goals we're talking about. So it sounds like that your position has changed on this proposal. And if so, could you explain why?
Dave Robertson again, Madam Chair. Our position has been refined somewhat as we've gone through our work group sessions. We have supported actually developing a plan to
toward the goals. We actually had language in early that gave us off-ramps for economic, social, and technological issues that were the PUC would find if the plan was too expensive or the technology was not ready, that they would provide off-ramps. Right now, the language says that the PUC, if they find that those things are the case, will do a report. We don't feel like that's an off-ramp. We feel it's a report. And we'd still be marching toward needing to do those reductions, and there would be no relief because it says that we shall do them. So right now, as we've looked at, shall develop a plan and shall achieve reductions are two very different things as you look at the legislative language.
Okay, and then I'm going to follow up because this is a PGE question for you, Dave. In the same letter, you state Oregon should not sign onto WCI, and that's what we heard last time. No cap and trade. Don't participate in the Western Climate Initiative. Or sign on to. I shouldn't say don't participate, but don't sign on to the Western Climate Initiative proposal, and should instead concentrate on other means of reducing greenhouse gases, such as enhanced energy efficiency, carbon capture and storage projects. I'm reading this verbatim. Renewable energy development and building code changes. So if we do all that, how in your view do we know if we're meeting or making any progress towards our goals?
Madam Chair, I believe the planning and scoping exercise that we need to do with the Utility Commission will give us some of that information. I mean, right now, I think the committee should understand, the utilities do resource planning every 2 years. We look at what our electric loads are going to be, and we try to figure out how to keep the lights on. How many generation plants do we need? How much energy efficiency do we need? What we're proposing to do is to do that same type of very detailed analysis on greenhouse gas reduction actions that can be taken. And so the ones that I mentioned in previous testimony would be some of the ones that we'd look at as we did our scoping and planning exercise at the Utility Commission.
And then why don't I let Scott respond?
No, go
first.
Ahead.
Sure. Scott Bolton for Pacific Corp. Just to speak clearly, from Pacific Corp's perspective on the Western Climate Initiative, we've been an active participant. We do business, Pacific Corp does, in four of the WCI jurisdictions. We've spent a lot of time and effort in helping work through the issues identified through that process. We certainly have not discouraged the state of Oregon or any other state from participating in what we think is a very important regional dialogue on what a cap-and-trade or greenhouse gas regulation system should look like. I think where we're in agreement with PGE and other stakeholders is that to actually implement a regional cap and trade system, especially one for us that does not include all of the jurisdictions that we serve, and why we prefer a federal program, does increase costs, does increase economic uncertainty and dislocation, I think, for businesses doing business in those states.
Okay. The Senator has a question. I have one more question, but I just want to be clear that, just for the record and people that are listening, this amendment is not this is not a cap and trade proposal, so I just want to be clear on that. One more question I guess I had for Dave, because I know there's been a change in leadership, as many people know. It's been in the news, and putting issues aside of executive compensation, can you talk about, is there been a leadership change? Because I'm hearing very different I'm hearing a different tone than what we've heard in the past, and I'm just curious if there's a different direction that's come out now with new leadership.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have had a change in leadership. Peggy Fowler has retired after 34 years with the utility, and we've got in her place a gentleman named Jim Pyro, who was the CFO and has been with the company only 31 years. And so he's taken the helm as the new president and CEO, and I would say that the general direction of the company is the same. We're investing in electric vehicles, and we're investing in renewables to reach the 25% goal. We're back lobbying in D.C. for a national cap and trade standard, and I've testified about why we believe national is better than state or a regional, unless certain conditions can be met. We're implementing a smart meters program. We're looking at carbon capture R&D out at our Boardman plant. All those things were happening a few months ago, and they're still happening now. I think our concerns about cost to customers when you're talking about a 75 to 100% rate increase would be the same and are still the same if this proposal had been made last year as it would be if this proposal was made 5 years from now.
Well, just for the record, I just want to make clear that the goals that we're talking about in this bill are the same goals we've been talking about for many years. And I think you guys acknowledge that. We were adopted 2 years ago. The goals haven't changed. So that I guess that was the crux of my question. because I, you know, up until this time we hadn't heard a concern that the goals were hard caps and meeting those goals were the same as a hard cap. So I just want to be clear on that. Senator Pozanski?
Yeah, thank you for the utilities. How much planning and scoping has actually occurred since the passage in 2007 of the bill that has these goals in it? How much has happened?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, PGE has actually submitted two integrated resource plans to the Utility Commission. The Utility Commission has developed a new rule in the last 2 years that actually helps to direct us look at how to price carbon reductions into our mix as we look at what generation plants to build and what carbon reductions would cost. That rule is in place. We're actually doing an update to that plan right now. We plan to submit that in June to the Utility Commission. We have a meeting tomorrow specifically focused on the Boardman plant and the pollution control reductions we have to do there and climate change costs and how those would affect us. So that planning is going on. I think that's in 2 years the Utility Commission's come up with a rule, and we're trying to implement that in our planning right now.
So it sounds like we have more time for more planning, what I'm hearing. How much more time until we start to see action, knowing that every year seems to put us behind the eight ball further?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, we have been and are continuing to do actions to reduce greenhouse gases right now. We're moving toward, and we've supported the 25% renewable energy standard. We're actually doing energy efficiency. We're sending another percent on top of the 3% system benefits charge for energy efficiency to the Energy Trust. So, and that's on top of what the Energy Trust already gets in renewables and energy efficiency. So there are a lot of things we're doing now to try to reduce this carbon profile. It's in our interest to reduce our carbon risk right now. And so we are trying to take as many actions as we can in light of the rules about lease cost planning at the Utility Commission. And lease cost, I think, through the new PUC rules, will include the cost of carbon. So that you're not just going to look at the cheapest generation plant. It will be that added to that will be the cost of what carbon is. And so you'll be able to do some apples-to-apples comparisons of various generation sources.
Scott, can you go ahead? Jonathan, and then my vice chair has a question.
Sure. Senator Pozanski, Madam Chair, I don't think this committee or anybody in this building should think that PacifiCorp or even PG or the state's major utilities are saying we should do nothing or that we have been doing nothing, whether since the passage of the aspirational goals or even previously when we came into this building supporting the renewable energy standard. And we know that a lot has to happen. We are making a lot of investments to try and achieve a lower carbon intensity product that we sell in the state of Oregon. And that's essentially what we're talking about with this legislation. We're talking about taking the carbon content down within electricity consumed in the state. And we're doing everything that we can within reason right now to do so. Our company just filed last week a general rate case, the first that we've had in 3 years. In that rate case includes costs of new clean energy resources, including over 1,000 megawatts of new natural gas plant and more renewables, on top of 8 new renewable projects that we brought in last year for the Oregon Commission to approve cost recovery on. But there's only so much cost that we believe our customers and the economy can bear. This rate case that we filed last week will be just over a 9% general rate increase, and that will affect different customer classes differently as those rates are spread among different classes of users. So we're doing the best that we can. We're moving forward. We're ramping up investment and, frankly, financing a lot of investment in a pretty tough economic climate to be doing these types of things. We're investing in a lot of transmission right now, which is necessary to actually get to and exploit more renewable energy resources in the country, and especially in Oregon and in the western region. So we know we need to be doing these things. We're doing them. We think that there's progress being made. We just think that the dash threes, and whether it's ambiguous or not, what the obligation is to meet the below 1990 standards still needs more work to achieve balance to make sure that we're balancing environmental obligation and the economic impact on customers.
Okay, Senator.
Thank you. I appreciate, Ms. Robertson, I think you said your willingness to stay at the table. But just a few panels ago, we heard a stakeholder who, it's the same work group, say that they don't take your commitment to the 2007 goals seriously, or that you're not taking them seriously. So that was actually my first question, is to have you reassure us that you take them seriously. But the second one, and it's a question for both of you, is you made a comment that you could see rate increases 75% to 100%. Now, those are huge rate increases. The same committee just had a cost cap on another bill a month ago that still has stalled in the House for unbelievably silly political reasons. What had a modest rate increase to it, or a cost protection in it, depending on how you look at it. But talk to me a little bit about, one, not being taken seriously, and two, a potential 75 to 100% rate increase.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, thanks for the question. Obviously, we take the goals seriously. They're in statute. We worked in the with the groups that pulled that bill in the last session, but the goals were set up as aspirational goals. I believe that that was the understanding. There are a number of aspirational goals in statute, recycling, and other targets that we try to meet and we think about as we start to plan, but we've never once supported the goals as a mandate to reduce, even in the 2007 session. So as that changes, that's where we start to get nervous and start to actually do some numbers and put some pencil to paper and realize what the costs are going to be. I agree, 75% to 100%, it sounds like a lot. It is a lot. Going that fast to make that many change-outs in power plants, we'd have to shut down a couple of coal plants and a couple of gas plants and reduce our market purchases significantly and replace those all with the only available resource that's not emitting in Oregon, which is wind, and we'd have to back that up with gas. So all of that investment costs a lot. We're very concerned that whether we'd be able to achieve that in the time frame that we have. Siting an electric transmission line or siting a power plant takes multiple years, 4 or 5 years. We're siting our Bigelow Canyon Wind Farm right now in Sherman County, 450 megawatts. That's taken 3 or 4 years just to get to phase two of that, and we still have phase three to go. So if we can only do 450 megawatts in 5 years, I'm not quite sure how we're going to get to an extra almost 3,000 megawatts in 9 years. So some of the physical problems of actually realistically doing that as a hard cap are problematic for us. I think I'm losing track of the actual question. You started with that question, Senator, so I apologize. So, a cost cap. Well, a cost cap was included as part of the renewable energy standard. Senate Bill 838, that last session passed. We supported a cost cap in there. The work group that talked about it actually came up with a structure in that bill that we were comfortable with. There were a number of other flexibility tools in that bill, an alternative compliance payment, banking and borrowing of renewable credits, a number of ways that we could actually flexibly meet the demands under that 25% mandate. In this legislation, with the hard cap, none of that exists. So concerned.
I just want to point out that there's language in Section 5 that are off-ramps that have a lot of language about cost impacts. So just want to make clear, I know you haven't had a chance to read through, but I think a lot of that was language that you guys had submitted. So I just want to put that on the record. Senator Prezanti, do you have one last question?
I do. I guess now what I'm hearing is, what's the position on a carbon tax? Should we just be looking at carbon tax to try to get this down?
Madam Chair, Senator Prezanti, that's a question for policymakers. What are the best tools?
What's your company's position on carbon tax?
My company's position is that a patchwork of states or different jurisdictions doing different things is economically harmful. If at the federal level, as we come under a national standard, if a cap and trade system, if a carbon tax, if some other regulatory framework makes the most sense that can actually achieve the environmental goals that we're setting out and do so in a way that doesn't irreversibly harm our economy, then that's something that we will support. The question here, Senator, really is, what can Oregon do and what should Oregon be doing?
That's my question is exactly. It sounds like we should be just sitting back and waiting for the feds to do whatever they're going to do whenever they do it, and we just sit back?
Well,
is that the position of your company?
My position, Senator, is that we absolutely should be preparing for that national framework. We should be ready to get the state to do the scoping and planning, to understand what our role is in the overall carbon picture, how we can maybe take some early actions, get credit for those early actions to start reducing now. But to self-start, to go ahead of other states, I think, and I think you'll hear from other businesses, that that is something that will economically disadvantage Oregon.
Interesting.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen and ladies. I want to call up people now that are over 100 miles away because I want to make sure we get to hear them. North Cheatham and Stuart Leibowitz, is that right? Okay, and we I apologize. Legislators don't have to adhere to the two-minute rule. And then also, is there anybody else here from 100 miles away? Don't have anybody else checked off, but I want to see if there's anybody else from 100 miles away that want to make sure you get to come up. Okay, so we'll call up Gary Grunke. Is Gary here? Okay, and then just trying to get other, like, Paul Cathcart. Is Paul here?
Yes.
Okay. And Catherine Thomason. Great. All right. Why don't we start on this end?
Thank you. Senator Dingfelter and the members of the committee, my name is North Cheatham. I'm from Hood River, and I do my best to argue for passage of what I consider to be public interest issues. This is a stellar example of that because it affects virtually everyone. The main crux of my testimony here is that carbon cap and trade must be implemented as soon as possible, and it will never be cheaper relative to GDP than it is right now. We wait, it becomes something in the order of 5% of GDP in the future because we've dilly-dallied around too long. Right now, it might be 1% of GDP going forward. That's the best estimates I've heard from the from my sources, mostly the Western Climate Initiative people. Furthermore, I think that what we need to do is concentrate on avoiding political instability and other consequences that would occur from inaction. I will skip a couple of points here for the interest of time. I will simply say that there have been major compromises in this issue so far, in this bill. I see that all the allowances that will be initially implemented to industry and the utilities and further to fuel people are being granted initially at no cost. This is different from the way the initial bill was originally set up. I am also very concerned about the we need a dedicated and secure funding for this matter because the way the issue is worded now, the legislature must appropriate funds to the Climate Improvement Fund to administer and mitigate impacts. This is a weak link and should be fixed. Please, Oregon is uniquely positioned to make this work with California. Please prepare us for an orderly transition and fix the funding and pass this issue.
Great. Thank you. We need a microphone and state your name, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Paul Cathcart. I'm the executive director for the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. We're a fish conservation nonprofit comprised of 14 chapters in Oregon and over 1,500 members located throughout Oregon, including the rural areas, and we're in full support of Senate Bill 80. Our organization's mission is anglers dedicated to protecting and enhancing fisheries and their habitats for today and the future. Climate change poses an immediate threat to this mission. For example, a projected 3-degree rise in average August temperatures, which is very plausible in 30 years, could render many of the streams in the Columbia, Snake River Basin, and coastal watersheds of Oregon too warm for steelhead, trout, and salmon, and other cold water species, thereby driving them to the brink of extinction. So it's an unsettling image to consider that Oregon would no longer have salmon and steelhead. And as we continually work throughout Oregon's communities to preserve our fisheries, the impacts of climate change in Oregon's rivers hit very close to home. As passionate anglers, we agree that if you spend enough days, months, and years fishing in the same spot, you'll notice changes in the river, and some subtle and some drastic. Across the state, several of these changes are painting a dim picture. And what we'd like to do is urge you to pass this bill, and I'd like to, as a postscript, to call your attention to the exhibit that we have attached to our testimony, which is a summary of 50 Oregon sportsmen groups who believe that global warming, there should be something to do with, be done about global warming. Thank you very much.
It is a great picture. I fish and I vote. I like that. It should be a bumper sticker.
Yeah. And there is one, too, like that. We can give you that.
I'm Stuart Leibowitz. I'm from the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, and thank you for this opportunity to speak to you regarding the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 80. As a member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, a grassroots organization dedicated to finding solutions to climate change, I strongly urge you to adopt the amendments that have been brought before you. As many of you know, the climate crisis has reached a critical stage, and it is absolutely imperative that this session emerge with legislation which will effectively lessen the impact of global warming. Now, this proposal represents a significant step toward that goal. It is comprehensive, accounting for the major sectors which produce global warming pollution, and by providing a clearly delineated path for state agencies to follow, this proposal will allow us to reach Oregon's greenhouse gas reduction goals, which have already been put into place by the 2007 legislature. And most important, it is eminently reasonable. This proposal addresses concerns about the original bill that were expressed by legislators, utilities, and the transportation sector. It will allow a smooth transition into a less carbon-intense economy while still reaching the goals scientists tell us are required to prevent a climate catastrophe. And allows the flexibility to determine the best means of getting where we all recognize we need to go. Many people have worked hard to come up with this proposal to meet the concerns of all those who will be affected by this legislation. With the world facing a totally ice-free Arctic in 30 years and Greenland melting faster than expected, it is no understatement to say that the climate crisis has reached a major turning point. Upon all of our shoulders rests the moral imperative to pass meaningful, comprehensive legislation swiftly and decisively. Future generations deserve no less than that.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Catherine Thomason. I'm with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I appreciate being able to testify, Madam Chair and committee members. I wrote out some of the implications of the public health impacts, which are going to cost enormous amounts of money. Dealing with climate change is going to cost a lot of money, and the more we pay up front to mitigate the changes, the less we pay at the other end. So I'm going to skip that segment, but just to say, we've already warmed 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit. We will warm another 3 degrees Fahrenheit, even if we do everything. If we don't do anything, if we're business as usual, we will warm another 11 degrees on average. That's average global temperature. So the amounts we're talking about are huge. We believe in that Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility feels that it's important for Oregon to address its share of the problem, and it's imperative to pass this new amended version, if only to codify, as you've heard countering statements about that, the current targets. The amendments to the original bill are a marked compromise from the original intent, and yet we, as an organization representing our members, are still in favor of passing it because we need a process to achieve the goals that we've set out. I'll leave it to others to advocate for various sections, which my understanding is the negotiators need to protect the utilities, need to protect the rates, and so on. But the role of the legislators is to keep the Oregonians' health and well-being of everyone here in the state in mind. The only specific thing that I'd like to mention is that I'm really concerned about having only the PUC be in charge of looking and providing oversight and planning for the utilities, which are a very significant segment of the CO2 emissions, and that it should be a broader, more integrated committee membership to create creative ideas to implement new plans. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming here to testify today. We appreciate it. Are there any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to keep going down the list, and let's see. We'll go back on the, I'm trying to alternate a little bit here on the for, against side, pro, con. Bob Jenks and Rachel Shimshack. And why don't we have, is Jeff Stone here? I didn't see Jeff. Okay, Steve Gutman and Ivan Molesky. Okay. Nope, not here.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Bob Jenks. I'm executive director of the Citizens Utility Board. I want to just say a few things real briefly. I wanted to start out to respond to a couple things we heard from the investor-owned utilities. The first thing is we do not read this as a hard cap in any way or any manner. The bill allows the commission, the Public Utility Commission, with reference to the utilities, to find that it's not technically feasible, to find that it's not economically feasible. In either of those cases, once the commission finds that, the commission can no longer hold them accountable. It wouldn't be, there's no way under the commission rules, the commission statutes, the commission can find something that's not technically feasible and then find the utilities imprudent for not doing something that's technically not feasible. I mean, that so we do not see this as a hard cap. If the commission reaches the findings that it's not economically or technically feasible, the commission can't hold them accountable under the commission statutes. That's the first point. The second point I wanted to make is the current PUC, the current utility planning process is broken, and it's broken because of carbon. We do a great job of doing 20-year integrated resource plans, but we don't know how to consider carbon because nobody's told us the rules. We need policymakers like you to tell us what to do with carbon, and then we can sit down in a utility integrated resource plan and figure out the least cost way to meet that policy. But right now, when we sit down in integrated resource plans to deal with carbon, we don't know if the cost of carbon regulation is $8 per ton as the utilities propose or $120 per ton as some of the environmentalists propose. And the difference in that is a huge difference. You could, under some of the utility guidelines, consider that carbon regulation is coming and build coal plants, as Pacific Core was proposing as recently as 2 years ago. We think the integrated resource plan won't work until the legislature or Congress tells us what to do about carbon. The third thing I wanted to say is utilities are great. The one thing I've learned in rate cases, utilities are great at exaggerating costs. We've been asking PGE for several days now to share with us their analysis that says this will raise rates 75 to 100%. I found that utilities, when they don't share things, it's probably not correct, and I would like to publicly call on PGE to share your analysis publicly so we can look at those numbers and see if they're real.
Great. Thank you, Bob. Rachel.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Rachel Shimshack. I'm the director of the Renewable Northwest Project. We're a regional advocacy organization. We promote solar, wind, and geothermal in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. Our members are both businesses, manufacturers, developers, marketers of renewable energy, and environmental groups and consumer groups. And I'm here today with just two messages, just to keep it short. One is that we support Senate Bill 80, and one of the reasons is that planning for electricity resources means you gotta have certainty, and carbon has been an area of uncertainty over these many years, and it makes it hard to figure out how you ought to plan for the future. This bill helps clarify for customers and utilities the costs and benefits and risks of each resource that would be evaluated. Certainly, energy efficiency is the cheapest and the cleanest resource, and we ought to maximize that, and this bill calls for that. But each decision about electricity generation has an impact for a generation, and we need to be really careful about how we go about it.
Valuing emission reduction strategies also will help stimulate the economy for clean energy solutions. And there are countless numbers of solar projects now. There are geothermal and biomass projects underway. And I can tell you that just 6 of the 13 wind projects that have happened in Oregon have prompted $1.25 billion in new capital investment, $2 to $4 million in annual royalty payments to the landowners who've sponsored those projects on their land, about $7 million annually in local property tax revenue to rural communities, and lots of construction and manufacturing and permanent jobs. There is stability with renewable resources because you get a fixed price for a long term, and you really can't say that about any other kind of resource. So we think it's good for consumers, good for the environment, and good for the economy of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ivan Molesky, the Conservation Coordinator with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. Happy to be here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 80. Sierra Club has been working throughout this legislative session to build consensus around Senate Bill 80 and identify areas of possible agreement among stakeholders to advance a piece of legislation built on common ground. We believe the current draft before you...
Ivan, we have your testimony, so...
I'm just going to paraphrase it, but
okay.
I did want to highlight a few things. Thank you, Madam Chair. We do believe the draft before you will move the state forward and to achieve significant reductions in greenhouse gases over time and provide state agencies the tools necessary to meet our goals. I do want to say that in that process, we did really move away from a hard cap, and I think that echoes what Bob Jenks from the Citizens Utility Board had said, to the point where we're looking at having the state agencies plan to meet goals to put this particular planning for the utilities at the Public Utility Commission, which is something that was a specific request of theirs. And this is essentially the same language around meeting the goals that the utilities had put forward. So we think we really moved a long way to get on the same page with them, and it's a little disappointing to see the opposition today. Part of the focus that I wanted to hone in on today, however, was some of the offsets language. The draft amendments before you have the Climate Change Advisory Council created, working with the Departments of Forestry and Agriculture, to develop rules around the use of offsets within the state's greenhouse gas reduction plans and establish guidelines to determine whether offsets are real, permanent, quantifiable, additional, and verifiable. We think this is very important because we think that offsets have the ability to capture what something that is very unique to Oregon, which is our forestry sector, our agricultural sector, and some of the benefits in carbon sequestration that good stewardship of our land can really bring to this state. So we think there are real opportunities here in terms of some of the offsets language that can have the kind of planning that we need to have Oregon, frankly, ahead of the curve as the state, region, federal government looks to develop these policies. We think there are real benefits for Oregon agriculture and forestry sectors. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff?
Madam Chair, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. We have not taken a formal position on Senate Bill 80. It's been... Oh, sorry.
No. Go ahead. Yes. He has a question for the panel, so go ahead, Jeff.
All right. Because of its fluidity, and so I would like to make that clear. Certainly, the nursery and greenhouse industry wants to be a participant, and it's harder to quantify, however, the use of the type of materials that we have with compared to a stand of forests. So I would agree that we need to make it quantifiable. The thing that I would add is that there's a whole host of things that are a benefit. You look at shade trees, you look at the use of plant material. It can reduce heat island effect within cities. It can produce, when you look at tree canopies in cities, it can help tremendously. If it can help with residential owners' cost to their utility by planting, and so they don't have to use their air conditioning during hot days by using the plant material that we provide, not only Oregon, but the nation. What I would point out is not only the use of plant material, but the type of good acting that some of our members already have done. Woodburn Nursery and Azalea, just up the road, reduced their energy use by 70%. Now, you may not think that's quite an accomplishment, but it's because they may become more efficient on natural gas use. Their savings on the grid alone would power the town of Independence for a year. And that's one grower. It's a big grower, but it shows you the type of impact a nursery can do if they can work with our utility partners, with our environmental partners, to try to help, because it makes sense bottom the bottom line sense economically, and also it's the right thing to do. The last thing I would mention is because if you look at plant material and you look at savings off the grid, we already are farmers utilizing climate knowledge every day. So I want to make that perfectly clear, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, and welcome. Senator Walker has joined us. Thank you. Vice Chair,
thank
you. Question.
Yeah. So it's a question for the panel at large. Some people say there's a hard cap and a cap, and most of you said there isn't. Tomato, tomato, potato, potato. I don't have the votes to call this whole thing off.
You can prick.
But
you can make a motion.
Good thing that Senator Walker's here now.
Two comments were made that I find a little distressing. One was you're calling somebody the utilities into question because they haven't provided their concerns about rates going up. I will tell you, after 10 years of being here, that if $1 goes up on the public purposes charge, I get hate mail. So if it's a 50% increase or a 35% increase, I think that's an issue we don't want to run over lightly. Here's my question for the panel. I've reviewed all the documents. I've reviewed and scanned to make sure that you use the same language that is used in the staff measure summary. Show me somewhere, please, in the dash threes, since you don't believe there's a cap there, demonstrate to me where the trade is. Because no one in an hour and 40 minutes has talked about the trade. Do we have no trade?
This is not a cap and trade. This is a cap with an off-ramp.
Okay.
And the PUC has several off-ramps. There's an off-ramp if it's not technologically feasible. There's an off-ramp if they find that it provides an economic hardship, and I believe they could find that to customers or the utility. And there's an off-ramp dealing with offsets. So I haven't had these dash three amendments very long, but I identified within 5 minutes three off-ramps that the commission has. So it's a goal with off-ramps if the goal cannot be met.
Anybody else want to comment on that? I think there's some confusion on this.
Senator Atkinson, I guess Ivan Molesky for the record from the Sierra Club. I guess I would say that the difference here is that Oregon established these goals in 2007. And
I was here.
Exactly. And if I'm not mistaken, I recall that you supported them.
I did.
And as did many, as the majority.
Not seriously enough, but I did.
And you're to be commended for that. And my comment here is that, our perspective is that these goals are to be meaningful. We need to begin taking steps to meet those. And what we heard very strongly from the utilities and some of the other folks is that if this was a quote-unquote hard cap, which is there were no off-ramps whatsoever, there are no ways to, if prices are going up unexpectedly or we're having extreme economic hardship, that we can't take a break or take stock of what the situation is, that would have been a hard cap and that was unacceptable. So what we tried to do is really come up with something that was utilizing their language in terms of, because what I've heard was a commitment for them to try to meet those goals, but they wanted to have opportunities to take a stock if we're having serious hardship in trying to meet those. And so that's what I think the difference is, that we're trying to meet the goals, we're planning to meet the goals, we're moving along the path on those goals we adopted in 2007, but we are creating opportunities to have a real discussion about what all the pieces need, are needed to be to get us there without causing terrible economic hardship.
Okay. Do you want to quickly, Jeff?
May I just take a quick crack? I mean,
lots of people want
the conundrum that we have, and the OAN has brought together the environmental community, utilities, the four corners of this debate, and really what it comes down to is what's the right thing to do. But conversely, Senator, to get to your point, if rates go up significantly, that's what my growers grow concerned about, because we're a very heavy energy user. And so, I mean, I think there's a balance between what's the right thing to do in terms of a carbon load, but also what's realistic and quantifiable. So off-ramps, I mean, I was confused by the off-ramp issue, but I think that we need to dig into this.
Rachel, if you want to comment, and then we'll move on.
I need to follow up after Rachel. Go ahead, I guess.
Madam Chair, Senator, I was going to just offer that
when you look at costs and rates, you need to look broadly. And one of the things that has been a market barrier for energy efficiency and renewables over these many years is there are externalities that are not reflected in the price of the resource. So carbon is an externality, and through this bill you value it and you consider it in the price so that you can compare resources equally across the board. Similarly, if you employ energy efficiency, you're helping reduce your bills. So you have to manage that in addition to the resource base that you're looking at. I think that this bill and all of us are going to experience a revolution of sorts in how we address our energy needs. And I think that this helps stimulate innovation, new ideas, and economic development in the state of Oregon. And I think that's what we need to build the future economy on.
Thank you. I was being facetious, and I'm very serious that RPS was supposed to innovate. RPS was supposed to have investments, which it did, which it was innovative. It was very successful. Then I read on page 6, subsection B, and then I hear about all these off-ramps that if the rates go too high, all the utilities have off-ramps. Well, to me, that just sounds redundant. RPS is working. And we've got we are going to debate all night long if we have a cap. And then there's no trade, but there's off-ramps if it gets too expensive. So the policy here is murky to me. I mean, it's just murky, murky, murky.
So,
and it's not getting
any cleaner.
I'll
let one person try to respond to the murky comment, and then we'll move on. And then we have another question. Yeah.
Utility planning in the day and age of carbon is murky. That's the first thing I will grant you. The RPS is working. The RPS, I think, is working tremendously well. We've seen a lot of investment in renewables. We also have utility systems that are growing, and utilities need to invest in resources anyway. They would be investing in other resources otherwise. But that doesn't mean that our systems are inherently becoming cleaner. It doesn't mean we're reducing emissions. It doesn't mean that we're addressing greenhouse gases in a way that will protect customers. The biggest fear I have as a consumer advocate, and my main concern is rates. My main concern is utility rates for the residential customers. That's my job. Is utility customers are the ones that are taking the risk. The planning doesn't work right now because we don't know how to plan around carbon. And if we plan wrong, if PGE goes in and puts $500 million into Boardman and then a federal cap and trade passes that closes Boardman, utility customers are going to have to pay that $500 million, plus they're going to have to pay for the new assets that replace that. PGE is not taking the risk. Customers are taking the risk. And until we can what I would like to do is I would like us to see us define the rules around carbon now before we make the investment, so the customers I represent don't have to make two investments, the wrong investment and then be told what the rules are and then make the right investment. That's what's going to, I think, is going to send our ratepayers to the initiative process. That's what's going to create problems. That's what's going to lead to people saying this is outrageous. And that's what I want to avoid, and that's why I'm calling on the committee and the legislature, give us the rules.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question of Mr. Jenks. And along the lines of Senator Atkinson, they don't call you. Customers in my district don't call you. They call me, and they call me when they're outraged or rates go up. So I take the brunt for what you just said. You made mention that this is a cap with off-ramps. And in your experience at Citizens Utility Board, I mean, you deal with these rates, so on and so forth like that, and I'm looking in multiple places, and you made mention, just example, page 12, bottom line, says cost-effective and technology feasible, so on and so forth, which is, that's the soft off-ramp that you're talking about. The people who determine whether it's technologically feasible or cost-effective for a utility or someone else to do this is the Policy Council. Can you explain to me what experience the Director of DEQ, the Director of Energy, the Department of Transportation have in determining what is technologically feasible and cost-effective in the private sector? I got PUC.
Right.
I disagree with you. I respect the PUC Commission. I think the Director and the Chairman can make a determination. But you got three agencies that have zero absolutely zero experience in determining cost-effective and technologies in the private sector. So why should those three people be the decision-makers?
I didn't read the bill as those three being the decision-makers, and if they are the decision-makers on the PUC off-ramps, then I think we ought to fix that. I think the PUC should be the decision-maker on the PUC off-ramps. And in Section 5, I read Section 5 to give the PUC the authority to find that things are not technologically feasible, that things present an economic hardship, and to set up the rules for the off-ramp. So I was envisioning the PUC being the role of the person deciding those off-ramps. I do have respect for the commission. I have respect for their staff. I believe they do have the technical capability to do that. So it may be that none of us have had the bill long enough and that there is murkiness over what the bill actually does, and if we need to I think, fix the bill. But it's my belief that the PUC should have the authority to determine those off-ramps for the investor-owned utilities.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. And I would just appear offline, you know, or ask you to offline to look at some of these sections, and I would be interested in your comments because I, too, have had this bill 45 minutes before we got here. So,
and I will just comment that it was the intent working with the drafters for the off-ramps to be in the section for the PUC oversight. So just want to make
and
sure.
I'm just reading verbatim from the bill. It says the Climate Policy Council.
Right. So I'm just telling you that's what the intent was. So I appreciate you writing. And just make sure and note the section. Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to call up a couple more panels or folks and try to get folks who can't come back. We are going to be holding over the hearing next week. So I do have some folks that I wanted to bring up that said they can't come back. Let's see, we have somebody from Albany signed up. Okay. Yeah, so why don't you come up, because I'm trying to call people that are further away and that are not paid lobbyists in this building. Let's see, we have Sarah O'Brien.
Madam Chair, I represent a group. If you'd like to come back next week, I'd be happy.
If you could, that would be great. Okay. Thank you very much on that. And if anybody could not, I just want to see a show of hands of people who can't come back next week. Why don't you come up? Okay, Kevin, come on up.
And for the record, Madam Chair, I get paid $18.81 to represent my citizens, which are a special interest group.
Yes, we all get paid the same. So that's the great beauty of the Oregon legislature.
Quality.
Yes. And you two gentlemen, why don't you come up, and then we'll just continue down the list. I would just want to make sure we got folks who could not come back. I'm not going to handle this.
Do I have a motion?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Please proceed.
Oh, my name is Richard E. Owen, PE, which is professional engineer. I'm retired, and I'm registered in Oregon, Arkansas, Louisiana, and South Carolina to practice engineering. I'm registered in the fields of mechanical, electrical, environmental, and manufacturing. I'm here to represent my family and one of the old citizens of Oregon to represent some of my ancestors. And they're, of course, they're not here. I have practiced and I have worked for Willamette Industries, and I've done a tremendous amount of work in this field of combustion engineering, of the CO2 in the atmosphere. And there's only 0.3% of CO2 in the atmosphere. We're talking about spending a lot of money right now to put a cap on this thing and send a lot of our businesses overseas. And when it comes to heating the environment, why, there's 50 million square feet of area if you cut the earth in half and what the sun can see and can heat. And it's the heat. And what my concern today is, you're putting a cap on CO2. You are missing the point completely on where the heating is coming from, because the heating is coming from the sun.
Thank you very much.
And my most important part, I'm against the bill.
Don't get that out. Go ahead. Don't miss that. You're against. Okay. go ahead.
Hey, I'm Gary Grocki. I had a transportation problem getting from room F, the overflow room, to here, and my name was called. But I'm the past chairman of the Oregon Electric Vehicle Association, which is a nonprofit organization of electric vehicle owners, which I am. I also work at a large semiconductor company in the state in the research lab for my day job. I just had basically three things to say. First of all, we've already got a proven technology in electric vehicles that can reduce greenhouse emissions in transportation. 100 years ago, most of the cars were electric cars, and we've seen with the EV1 and General Motors and Volt and Nissan's offerings that we can keep up with modern day cars. The only part is the battery technology. It's adequate for today, and it's doubling every 10 years. So the Moore's Law for battery technology is every 10 years it gets twice as good. It's a little slower than computers, but still adequate. Secondly, electric cars, while they cost more, the total cost of ownership over the lifetime is a good deal for the consumer. It's like getting a 30 years future contract on the price of gasoline. I wish I could do it for food and health care. So it costs more, but 2 cents a mile and no maintenance on the car, it pays off and becomes a good investment. Thirdly, with respect to renewable energies, it's a very good offering because it could, together with your renewable resource and smart charging, we can actually provide profits for utilities because in Austin they have big wind farms and they formed a consortium to get people to charge the cars at night when the wind is still blowing and nobody wants the electricity. Somebody from EPRA said this basically could give us 30% more profits with no additional investment. But, you know, choose your thing. You could lower rates as well. The other way you really win is utilities right now work in that demand is uncontrolled and they control the generation sources. But Mother Nature does not. Mother Nature is not controllable. But what we can do is control when cars charge so that it works out. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry to slip away.
Welcome back. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Kevin Owens. I'm general manager of Columbia River PUD in St. Helens, Oregon. And I'm here today as the chairman of the Oregon People's Utility District Association, their chair of their legislative committee. I'm here on behalf of the 170,000 Oregonians that we serve in the state. My comments today will address SB 80. I will not offer specific comments regarding the currently proposed amendments that came out before the meeting today, but I would encourage the committee to give thoughtful consideration in light of the weak economy to ensure that no unintended consequences occur to our customers as a result of additional state mandates, additional oversight beyond our local control that we provide to our customers through our boards of directors. Oregon PUDs, along with the municipals and cooperative utilities in the state, are public preference customers of the Bonneville Power Administration. What that means to us in relation to this bill is that the power supplied to us from the Bonneville Power Administration, 81% of that this year in our purchases from BPA, 81% of that is clean, renewable hydropower. Another 10% comes from the Columbia Generating Station, which means that over 90% absolutely has no carbon footprint or produces any greenhouse gases. Now, when you take that a step further, each one of these PUDs in the state already has invested significantly in renewable generation, whether it be fish-friendly hydro, solar, wind farms, so forth. They've done that in the past. They've done it on their own. Our concerns is that additional oversight and mandates will yield negligible benefits to Oregonians. I included a graph in my testimony. It shows where we lie on the greater spectrum as far as contribution of CO2 metric tons within the state. I'll call to your attention that we have a strained economy out there. We need to be focused on retaining jobs and keeping jobs, and currently working, all public power is working with Bonneville Power Administration. We're looking at a rate increase for our power supply of anywhere from 10 to 20%. that'll hit us this October. Okay. When power supply is 60 to 80% of our operating costs, it's significant. So we're looking very, very closely at any costs that'll be put upon our customers. Okay. And we've done an excellent track record with our boards in the past.
And thank
you
very much.
We don't see that changing in the future.
Thank you. Okay. And last.
For the record, my name is Barry Bashu. I farm near Boring, Oregon, raise berries, nursery stock, flowering baskets, and a lot of other things. I'm also the elected president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation here to represent them today in opposing this bill. I think we're behind the curve a little bit. I heard a lot of discussion about the various people involved in all these work groups. I didn't hear anything about production agriculture being involved in those, so I'm assuming that was an unfortunate oversight. But I would like to make some points here today regarding this. Agriculture is a large user of energy and electricity. We use it to generate heat for our greenhouses. We use it for transportation. We use it for all the other products that we use, natural gas, liquid natural gas, propane, and all these are high energy costs. If you increase our electricity cost to meet some of these requirements up to 20%, my irrigation bill is already $1,000 a month. With this downturn in the economy, I'm looking at 50% to 60% less sales than I've had in the last 2 years. You add another $2,000 a year to electrical costs, and that effectively puts me out of business. 236,000 is a number I want you to keep in the back of your mind. That's currently the number of unemployed people in the state of Oregon. This bill increases costs for transportation, increases costs for utilities, for rates, for the cost of energy and heating people's homes. Now is the time for Oregon to be investing in its business community and the creation of jobs and not some draconian legislation which keeps people out of business and continues to put people out of work. I guess I would just make the final comment that now is the time, perhaps instead of waiting for December, maybe, as I believe Senator Atkinson alluded to earlier, maybe now is the time to take the off-ramp and save us a lot of time and a lot of energy and hopefully a lot of jobs in this state. So once again, I was thrilled to hear that the Sierra Club has recognized the value of agriculture in the state of Oregon finally, but I would point out that this is not a bill that's going to help us. The offset costs for this, for our diverse agriculture, do not meet those requirements and make it almost difficult and impossible to go. So
thank you
for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for these folks?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Senator Brookquist.
Go away, Barry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Barry, in the last hearing we had, there was some testimony from one of the agencies of the state government. I don't recall exactly which one, and it was a response to a question Senator Nelson had posed to them and asked them how they viewed farming as a carbon producer. Because Senator Nelson's question was, is farming create a carbon offset or so on and so forth like that? I'm just curious if the Department of Agriculture or anyone from the governor's staff or the agencies have entertained discussions with the Farm Bureau on why they perceive that farming is a net negative in terms of producing carbon, or what type of farming practices might produce a positive.
Sorry, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, not that I'm aware of. They may have contacted one of our governmental affairs staff here, but I am unaware of any outreach by any of these agencies. I think it's interesting in this bill that there's a lot of power given to this coordinating council, and it does not include any of the natural resource agencies. And I think that's if the Senate decides to persist with this bill, I would hope that they would at least rectify that and bring the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Water Resources, and the Department of Forestry on board, because clearly there's an investment in agriculture and sequestering carbon right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thanks for coming here today. Appreciate it. There's a couple other folks that I was told cannot return. Mike Siebers and Drew Gilpin, did I get that right? And then I know Joe Esmond, I don't know if you can come back. If not,
I can come back and I'll see the position.
Okay. Is there anybody else who can't come back? Okay. Come. You and you. Steve, sorry. You were called before, but I don't know what happened.
There were no seats up here.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Why don't you go ahead since you're up there first, Steve.
Thanks.
Sorry about that.
So my name is Steve Gutman. Sorry.
Go ahead.
My name is Steve Gutman. I'm with a company called EcoSecurities. We're a London-based firm that for the last 11 years has been developing carbon offset projects under the Kyoto Protocol. And I think there's been a lot of back and forth and a lot of, frankly, sort of fear-mongering about what would happen under any sort of a scheme where carbon is regulated. Again, we've been operating in regulated environments for about 11 years under Kyoto and also under the European Emissions Trading System. And there hasn't been any sort of doomsday scenario. Rates haven't gone through the roof. And in fact, there have been lots and lots of economic opportunities created, a few of which I think are directly relevant to communities here in Oregon, particularly communities that are dependent on agriculture and forestry. And rather than generalize, I'm just going to talk about three specific examples of the kinds of projects that our company has actively invested in other countries around the world. Those include things like biomass fuel switching. When a price is put on carbon, generating plants over time develop ways of mixing biomass fuels, biomass-based fuels, into their generation mix. For example, a coal-generating plant might start to blend in wood chips and other woody biomass that has been removed from forests. Oregon has abundant forests, and in fact, I've been talking to the Oregon Department of Forestry about this opportunity, has a lot of forests that have a lot of downed woody biomass that has accrued over the last 50 years as a result of fire suppression. It's currently uneconomic to get that woody biomass out of the forests, but what we've done in Chile, what EcoSecurities has done in Chile and other countries where there's a price on carbon, is you can gather that biomass, you can grind it, you can develop it into wood pellets and co-fire it in coal-burning plants. Similarly, you can extend harvest rotations in forests, and what ends up happening is that the generating plants that are under caps end up paying forest landowners to extend the harvest rotations on their forests. And then thirdly, for agriculture, precision agriculture is a new technology that dramatically reduces the greenhouse gas emissions associated with farming, and those sorts of projects are enabled through the carbon markets.
Thank you, Stephen. Sorry I didn't see you before when I called you up, but thanks for coming today.
I'm Mike Siebert, Madam Chair, committee members, president of Blue Heron Paper Company. And I've been here before, and I'm here again to promote the same thing in a little bit different way. And really that is, yeah, I think Oregon needs to get prepared for a federal program that regulates carbon-based emissions, but really shouldn't be blazing the trail in advance of that. And the reason is businesses like ours, who are a small company, we're a very globally oriented company. We sell commodity products into the global world. We compete with other mills and companies that are in other states. And for Oregon to run ahead on an issue like this could just really harm our ability to stay competitive. We work on very thin margins, and our competitiveness could be evaporated by issues if not handled correctly with a bill like this. We think we already have green jobs. We do a lot of recycling in our company under very tight environmental controls already. We have very good wages, but we're concerned that non-competitive issues created by Senate Bill 80 and the amendments suggested here could wipe out the benefit we have that keeps us in business today. We have already reduced our electricity and gas use both by 20% in our facility since 1990. But I'm concerned we might not get credit for that under the bill that's being crafted today. We pay a very large public purpose charge already. We pay anywhere from $35,000 to $75,000 a month in public purpose charge. But we're concerned about leakage and us going away related to that. And finally, just a quick point on the details of the amendments as proposed, and I know I speak for ourselves and as a Northwest Pulp and Paper member that we're very concerned about sections 9 and 10, and we would oppose those sections because they seem to compete with each other in a certain way. Section 9 intimates there's a hard cap and off-ramps that can be taken if things aren't good, but Section 10 at the end says at the end of the day the DQ and there's going to be a program mandated that gets the desired reductions in carbon emissions. The two compete with each other.
Okay, thank you. We're
opposed.
State your name, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for calling me early. My name is Gordon Folks. I'm a physicist. I'm probably the only scientist here today. And no one is paying me to testify, and that's very important to understand. It's not a good idea for you to be paying some scientists to tell you what you want to hear. Not good for them and very dangerous for you. Politicized science is very dangerous. You need scientists who have not been compromised. In real science, where real evidence is required, anthropogenic global warming has completely collapsed. The science supposedly underpinning SB 80 has completely collapsed. The handout that I'm providing to you is a full-page ad that ran last week in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Washington Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the Los Angeles Times. And it is signed by many scientists, over 100 of us, and it says, in part, we, the undersigned scientists, maintain that the case for alarm regarding climate change is grossly exaggerated. The computer models forecasting rapid temperature change abjectly fail to explain recent climate behavior. One of the signatories down here is the man who did the work. Mr. President, because this addressed Barack Obama, your characterization of the scientific facts regarding climate change and the degree of certainty informing the scientific debate is simply incorrect. Now, this is signed by scientists from all over the world. There are three of us from the Pacific Northwest, including George Taylor, the former state climatologist. It's produced by the Cato Institute, which is reportedly a libertarian think tank, but no one asked us what our political affiliations are, and I don't know what most of them are here. I would note that there is one Republican, so he's probably suspect to you, but there are several staunch Democrats.
There are Republicans up here, by the way. There's one.
Well, okay.
Well, I am considered suspect.
There are several staunch Democrats on this list, and there are a number of leftists also. Let me point out that Ivar Gaever endorsed Barack Obama for president, and he is very well known. He has a Nobel Prize in physics. Martin Hertzberg, whom I provided material to you before, is a staunch Democrat. Antonio Zucicci, the president of the World Federation of Scientists and a professor of advanced physics from Italy, is a leftist. But note also particularly Richard Lindzen, whose politics I don't know. He is probably the most outstanding meteorologist on the planet.
Okay, thank
today.
You, Mr. Thank you. Fultz. Thank you for coming today.
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Neil Nelson. I'm President and CEO of Siltronic Corporation. We are the North American arm of the third largest silicon producer in the world. In addition to providing world-class products to global customers, I am proud to say that Siltronic has been a strong member of the Oregon community for nearly 30 years. We also provide over 800 people with manufacturing-level wage jobs. However, escalating costs, including electricity rates, have increased more than 50%, and poor market conditions have caused a more than 40% employment reduction at our facility since 2001. To remain globally competitive, we work hard to control costs, but we cannot control many of the costs, including energy. Instead, it's manifest in the loss of about 800 jobs since 2001. The historical poor economy has required us to make tough decisions even this year, as we have put existing employees on furlough and all the rest of the employees are taking time off. Siltronic has a number of concerns regarding the proposed legislation. The primary concern is that greenhouse gas regulation on a state or region-only basis would severely be detrimental to Oregon-based companies' ability to compete globally and employ locally. The legislation further will drive up energy costs for Oregon business in this very difficult economy. I'll skip some. Let me be clear. Siltronic is not opposed to greenhouse gas regulation. Siltronic has more than 20 environmental awards, including the Governor's Sustainability Award, and we are highly recognized as an environmental leader. We've set goals and we've obtained them. As a result of these programs since 2003, we are producing 42% more product per pound of carbon dioxide emitted.
So we applaud your efforts to pursue global warming. However, a state and regional-only approach would severely disadvantage Oregon business. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. We have about 10 people signed up or any of the people that signed up cannot come back next week. Okay. Why don't you come up? And then we're going to close the public hearing. We'll carry it over until next week. Well, it'll also be on the agenda. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. You state your name for the record, please.
Madam Dingenfelder, Senator Dingenfelder, members of the committee, my name is Mike Gadern. I am the president and CEO of Woodlands Carbon. Woodlands Carbon Company has been created by the family woodland owners in this state, specifically Oregon Small Woodlands Association. In 2006, the association passed policy regarding moving towards a low carbon economy. They've then since taken action on that with the creation of the company. We oppose the current -3 amendments of Senate Bill 80 because we believe that this would put Oregon out in front of markets that we're already involved in. There are voluntary markets for CO2 in this country right now, and we believe that they are the framework that we will probably be working with at federal level when a cap and trade comes, if it comes, in a regulatory form. We prefer them to stay voluntary, as we would prefer all ecosystem markets. My own experience suggests that if we are to go out ahead of the game, as maybe the Western world did with forest certification, we could find ourselves with some unintended consequences. And those unintended consequences are leakage. It's a very important thing to recognize that if you create incentives in other parts of the world, but don't create incentives here in Oregon and in the U.S. to continue the good practices, you may find supply and demand creating opportunities elsewhere to basically improve their behavior to our legal levels, but there are no incentives for us to continue our legal good forest management and sustainable forest management. Therefore, people turn to other land uses that have negative impacts on climate change and the storage of carbon in sustainable forestry and wood products. So I would urge extreme caution. My experience has been with the World Wildlife Fund and Global Forest Trade. We have talked about climate change in that organization for over 10 years, and with working with the Small Woodlands Association, I think we have taken the necessary steps to engage with voluntary carbon markets, and I look forward to us and Oregon being successful in our efforts to create a viable, long-term carbon reduction strategy.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for coming today.
I appreciate the time because we're actually out there building markets right now, so I won't be in the state next week.
Okay. Thank you. Cindy, I didn't know you couldn't come back, so why don't you guys go pretty quickly, and then we have about 10 more people we'll hear next week.
Madam Chair, for the record, Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, and we did submit written comments. I'll just quickly, consumer-owned utilities in Oregon, as you know, rely primarily on hydropower. That hydropower comes with its own set of, it has many benefits, but it also comes with its own set of environmental mitigation and expenses. About 30% of the cost of our wholesale power bill from Bonneville goes toward fish mitigation. That's about an extra 15% on our retail customers' bills. We do have, in addition to that, a very small carbon footprint due to unspecified market purchases that Bonneville makes when the wind doesn't blow, when the market goes wrong, or to fill in during low water years. Those are unspecified. There's no real way for us to reduce those emissions. So under a carbon reduction mandate, we would have to either buy offsets or beyond what we would do through energy efficiency and renewables. Given all that, looking at the goals here, what we've tried to do is put forward a proposal that creates a platform for our utilities to fund carbon reduction at the local level. Basically, what we're trying to say is if we want to focus our efforts on energy efficiency and renewables rather than buying trees in Brazil, and we can do those jobs at home. The specifics of our proposal is in there. It's a 2% charge, carbon reduction charge on our electric retail sales revenues to fund a broad spectrum of carbon reduction measures. We want to thank Chair Dingfelder and other members of the committee for working with us on that. We didn't see the JASH three amendments, of course, until just now. There are a couple of changes that got in there that were not in our proposal that we do have concerns about. We'll talk to you about those later and also have some comments on the rest of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Tom, Cindy, do you want to add anything?
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, first of all, thank you for the consideration. I'm going to be very, very brief. Tom gave the meat of our testimony, which is about our carbon reduction plan that we have worked for about the past year on. And I think what we'd like to share with you and make sure you understand is, you know, that is a big effort on our part to be team players. We want to be part of the carbon reduction strategy in Oregon, and we think that we came up with a way to do that that works for our small utilities and our small communities. So, but I want to also say that given that effort, we also came in with that being our alternative path. And that clearly for us means that we will stand behind that proposal, but it will be very, very difficult for us to accept any other additional cost of other climate change programs. So we hope that you are looking at that as we are, and that is as an alternative path. We did not see the bill in advance or the amendments in advance, so we're really not going to comment on any of that at this point in time, but we will be looking at it with a couple of things in mind. One is impact on our customers, residential, commercial, and industrial. Job losses in our small communities are huge, and I guess we aren't convinced that those job losses are going to be replaced with green jobs. That I think the jury is still out on that. So it's very important to our small communities. We do not want to simply raise revenue for the purpose of raising revenue. We are very, very interested in real carbon reduction, and we think we've come up with a plan for us to do that. We also want to make sure we've got reliability. We are charged with keeping the lights on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that means we do have to have reliability. We do have to firm and shape renewable power. And that is incredibly important in this discussion. And I guess lastly, I would say that in keeping with the proposal that we have given you, being able to maintain local control, which is in our proposal for our utilities, the 36 small utilities in this state, is very, very, very important. Not being able to do that adds incredible amount of cost to our utilities, and so we would hope that you would support our efforts to step up with this 2% reduction plan, but also keep that our alternative path, and lastly, make sure that we do maintain local control of our utilities, because that's how we can keep the lights on at a reasonable cost in rural Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Sandy. Any questions for these folks? Okay, with that, just a couple of comments. The record, it will be open until the public hearing next week. That'll be posted. It'll be either Tuesday or Thursday after we need to look at the agenda when my committee staff gets back. I want to thank the folks who are willing to come back next week on that and thank all the committee members who stayed over a few minutes. Certainly, the chair appreciates that. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 80 and close the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee.